Ms. Jolly.
May it please the court, I am Susan Jolly, representing Petitioner Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, a union representing 55,000 employees at 20 U.S. airlines. With the court's permission, I will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Under governing international treaty and U.S. law, only U.S. citizen air carriers are entitled to enter domestic airline markets. Contrary to law, Virgin America was created and is actually controlled by British nationals Sir Richard Branson and his affiliated Virgin Group. DOT initially concluded that Virgin America was under the actual control of a foreign national and its application should be denied. The final order granting the certificate is arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion, and otherwise contrary to law, because none of the substantial business relationships that caused DOT to conclude the application should be denied have changed.
Could you address standing?
Yes. The statute provides expressly that any person disclosing a substantial interest in the DOT order may appeal to this court.
All right. Now, the disclosing a substantial interest, would you agree that at least until your reply brief, there was no compliance with our Sierra Club precedent? That is, if your standing is not self-evident, then you've got to show us what your standing is based on with your first submission, which you didn't do until, well, you didn't do, and then in the reply brief you have some declarations.
With respect, we did offer an affidavit in the first opening brief, which is an affirmation by union president that specified discussions with the employer at issue who had identified increased competition by Virgin America as a source of the requirement to furlough flight attendants. We also made argument in that opening brief, which would be sufficient to satisfy the Sierra Club requirements.
Well, it just seems awfully speculative to me. The declarations that I remember are based on understandings, you know, using language that's pretty vague and loose.
You're talking about the Wells Declaration, the affidavit of, is it Kelly? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
Kelly Porter Wells? That's the sole basis, that's the sole evidentiary basis for your standing argument in your opening brief.
Well, there's also argument which is based on economic analysis, which provides a justification. We cited, too, the argument that was made to the department before. There were comments submitted identifying more particular detail, the nature of the injury that was expected from an adverse DOT decision in this case. So,
but your only evidentiary showing is the affidavit of Kelly Porter Wells, right? I mean, there is argument. But
well, again, I think the case and issue, Sierra Club, accounts for the fact that there may be instances in which standing is self-evident and that the requirement to provide evidentiary proof of injury really is after the respondent decides to make an issue of the standing of the party. So I would say that the process that we followed in this case comports with the case law.
I don't think that's how we read Sierra Club. At least how I read Sierra Club and our rules is the burden is on you to show that there's constitutional standing here. And as I understand it, I mean, you've attempted to do that in the Wells Declaration, and I guess your argument also is that it's self-evident. You wouldn't need it.
Yes, that the economic injury from competition, unfair competition, is something that the respondent concedes would be self-evident basis for standing. And we would argue that it logically follows that employees of that injured airline would likewise, quite logically, be self-evidently have the standing to challenge the order of the DOT.
Of course, DOT argues that the materials that you reference in your brief actually support an argument that there are other reasons why there have been decreased flights. The newspaper articles that we're all aware of that cite increasing fuel costs, general economic downturn. So that raises a pretty significant issue in my mind about redressability, right? In fact, if we agreed with you that the Department of Transportation made a mistake here, was arbitrary and capricious, would it result in and jobs for your folks?
Yes. If DOT were to grant the remedy, which is being requested on remand, which is revocation of the Virgin America certificate, then you would have 26 less aircraft flying in the United States, and it is likely that that capacity would be filled by existing U.S. carriers, many if not all of whom employ AFA members. And the injury need only be traceable to the DOT order. And the DOT order need not be exclusive.
That's right. In terms of causation, but in terms of redressability, we have to be certain that if we sided with you, that it would give your clients the relief they seek. What about the point that the government makes that, in fact, the evidence shows that, at least on the West Coast, there was increased flights from competitors once Virgin America entered the market? Is that not true?
I think they cited one city pair, and you really cannot decide what the cause of that may be. One of the impediments we've had in this case is not only the confidentiality under which everything in this case has been filed, but also, until recently, Virgin America's sought confidential treatment of its traffic data, which all other air carriers report in the public domain. DOT only several days ago ordered Virgin America to produce that information. Had we had access to that information, we might have been able to offer a better case to show the exact impact, adverse financial impact, that Virgin America's entry has had in other city pair markets. So we have been frustrated in our ability to develop the kind of evidence that you may seek in this case.
Where are the airlines? Why aren't they in this dispute?
Excuse me?
Where are the airlines? They were actively involved before the Department of Transportation. Why aren't they?
Well, I'm not privy to their reasons, but I think that it would be improper to infer that the only motivation that they have are the proceedings or the merits of a case before this court. They may see other broader political or commercial implications from a decision to participate, to continue appeal. It's obviously costly in an environment in which the financial state of the industry is not good. And they may have concluded that they were better off of pursuing other ways of dealing with this. These issues have been before Congress and will likely continue to be before Congress.
What more do you think Virgin America needs to do to be independent in your views of foreign control?
In every instance in which an applicant has been created by and has exhibited so many substantial business relationships between the foreign owner and the putative U.S. owners, DOT has sought to isolate that foreign ownership group. And a perfect example is the DHL Airways case, in which there's basically a sale of the carrier and its assets to a completely independent U.S. Interest. And the foreign group, therefore...
What do you mean by completely independent?
It was a new set of owners and managers.
You say that DOT here applied an actual control standard that differed from what you think Congress contemplated. Can you describe to me what you think that difference is?
In the first show cause, DOT actually did exactly what Congress directed. In 2003, the words actual control were inserted into the U.S. citizenship definition to incorporate a term of art that had been developed and understood from agency precedent. And that was described to Congress in a report. And there were seven factors titled indicia of control that frequently occurred under the DOT precedent. And of those, five remain after the show cause. So there are buyout provisions, equity interests, financing, significant contracts, and business relationships. So what we contend is that DOT really must enforce the law in as set forth in the agency precedent. It's not free to come to any result it deems reasonable.
Okay, but as I read this record, DOT actually did that. I mean, they basically sent Virgin back to the drawing board and requested substantially more, you know, mitigating actions and so forth. So what I'm trying to get at is where in the record does it show that DOT actually failed to establish those factors?
They didn't address the substantial business relationships that survived. So its first fundamental holding was that Virgin America's affairs were structured for the benefit of the foreign carrier, and that has not changed. Through contracts that were entered into before the U.S. owners were brought into the picture, Virgin America was tied into a way of doing business that benefits the foreign carrier. They negotiated aircraft leases, airport leases, all the business contracts, and they locked them into a way of doing business, which in the second show cause order, DOT says, well, we're free to, in theory, exit all these business relationships. Well, in the real world, that's a freedom you couldn't exercise. It's not practical. So the...
Yeah, all those were subsequently ratified by the new board, right?
Yes, but the board that ratified them, or the independent directors, were the same directors that DOT had earlier held, were brought in merely for the purpose of creating the impression of U.S. ownership. And there were detailed findings in the first show cause with respect to relationships between those parties, that investor group, and their hedge fund managers. They were brought in to, again, create an impression of U.S. ownership. They're really investors, they're really lenders, they are not necessarily the kind of true airline owner who is pursuing the venture for the purpose of being in the airline business. And we are operating under a sealed record here, so I can just refer you to some of the inducements that would cause you to believe, or arrangements that would cause you to believe that's a true statement. These are addressed in the business plan at pages 38, excuse me, the opening brief at page 49, and pages 23 and 24 of the reply brief. The investors stated they're committed to implementing the Virgin Group business plan, and given the inducements and the potential of jeopardizing those arrangements were they to exercise truly independent judgment, we have to conclude that they really have financial incentives as hedge fund managers to continue to defer to the wishes of the foreign nationals.
Now, is your allegation that there's some furtive agreement between the managers and the directors that would run their allegiance towards the Virgin Group or to
There are many agreements that were not produced. Key among them is a business plan. It was an actual presentation made to this group of investors. It is a linchpin document. It is cited as exhibits or internally in a number of other key documents. So loan agreements, shareholder agreements, the third put agreement, which guarantees a particular rate of return to the hedge fund investors. That business plan was never produced, and yet it's the critical document. It would tell you the answer to that question. There are also references periodically to side agreements. It's not clear to me whether they were all produced or not. So, and there's certainly after the DOT final order was issued, there was nothing that really inhibited them from entering into any number of side agreements. Again, not subject then to public disclosure.
This is just an informational question. Part of your argument is that the entry of this airline would reduce the need for services by incumbent airlines, but you represent flight attendants. And so why couldn't you represent Virgin's flight attendants?
I guess that is theoretically possible, but the duty is to represent the existing members of the union, and the threat here, I think, is let's just not focus on Virgin America. There's a template being created here, a game plan. And if it is possible for foreign air carrier interests to come into the United States in the guise of a foreign U.S.-owned airline, then you have the possibility of eroding the competitive fabric of the U.S. industry, and ultimately to the detriment of that industry and the carriers who support it.
All right, thank you.
Has Congress reacted to this in any way? They've been big players in this actual control language. Have they reacted to the entry of Virgin America in any way?
One of the impediments we truly suffer under here is the only thing that's publicly disseminated is a press release that says there were significant changes. The detail of whether or not these changes were significant, what exactly was done, is something that's shrouded in secrecy. And so it's very difficult for opponents of this transaction to petition Congress to let them know what's really happened. And so this court, it's incumbent on this court.
Congress hasn't reacted in any way?
There may be initiatives, but to my knowledge, the last thing they did was basically there was legislation pending that would have basically stopped the department's initiative to liberalize foreign ownership and control, and the Congress acted to...
But nothing in reaction to this particular, to Virgin America getting the certificate?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Mary Witham, and I represent the respondent. My time will be 11 minutes, and 4 minutes will be shared with the intervener, Virgin America. First of all, I'd like to just provide a little bit of just quick background and context here that before I get into the standing and the merits, which I think is important. Virgin America was granted effective certificate authority to operate more than 18 months ago and has been operating continuously since that time. AFA never sought a stay of the DOT decision to stop Virgin America from flying. Virgin America employs hundreds of persons, including pilots, flight attendants, and other skilled workers to fulfill its commercial operations, and AFA, like any other union, is free to try to organize Virgin America's flight attendants. In fact, there's a basis in federal law for their right to seek to unionize them. Virgin America is also, as a U.S. carrier, is bound by the same strict regulatory regime as are all other U.S. carriers. As to the merits here, the department performed a very rigorous review under the totality of the circumstances standard, and which is entirely consistent with the OIG report, which was mentioned in the briefing. And when I have an opportunity, I will actually go through and show where the seven factors outlined in the OIG report were in fact complied with.
I want to hear how this is different than the DHL example.
The DHL example, in that case. In that case, DHL involved a case where DHL initially controlled all employment decision. It controlled financial operations. Initially, it formulated budgets and it established the financial statements. There was a specific outside agreement where there was control by the foreign investors as to the acquisition of assets and as to any recapitalization, restructuring, and also there was...
Is it true, as counsel said, that what DOT required there was a completely new team, a new purchase,
No, in fact, there certainly were some new owners, but it wasn't completely new. There were, and much like in Virgin America here, we're not talking about the same exact people. There was some change in terms of the senior management. There was some change in terms of the board. In fact, if you look at the record here, not only was the CEO removed, Mr. Frederick Reed, because of his longstanding ties to the Virgin Group, but David Cush was brought in. He had no, as CEO, he had no affiliation with the Virgin Group, and Don Carty.
They claim that Secretary Skinner is something of a fig leaf. Is that true, or?
I think he would disagree with that. He was formerly the obviously, as we know, the head of the Department of Transportation.
What's he do now with Virgin America?
Excuse me?
What does he do now with Virgin America? I mean,
he's the vice chairman of Virgin America, so he is intimately involved with any of the decision-making that board members traditionally would be involved with in a board of directors. Now, the department correctly ruled that Virgin America would be under the actual control of U.S. citizens after reviewing one of the largest citizenship dockets assembled at DOT. There were over 15,000 entries in this particular docket. But before turning to the merits of the citizenship determination, I'd like to address the threshold argument the petitioner lacks standing.
I'd like to particularly address the affidavits they attached to their final reply brief.
Yes. Your Honor,
they're a lot better than the Wells affidavit, right? I mean, they're better. It's a better...
Well, I don't think that they're any better, Your Honor, because if you look at them, in fact, what they say is that they had heard from United Airlines or that that possible furloughs were due in part to low-cost carriers, including Virgin America. I think that what those show is that they are, in fact, they lack the type of specificity and concreteness that's required. They are actually very hypothetical in terms of the injury that is to be, that they claim that they are suffering or that they may be suffered as a result of furloughs. The other thing that I think is important here is that there is an issue, as you noted earlier, in terms of redressability. What those affidavits say is that the alleged furloughs are due in part to the entry of Virgin America. So clearly there are some other factors involved, including perhaps the high fuel prices, the reduced consumer spending, and it could be even just management decisions.
I'm looking at Ms. Meyer's affidavit. It doesn't sound too hypothetical to me. She's lost her job, lost her income. The Department of Transportation allowance of entry by Virgin America has been part of the reason they've had to reduce their flight attendant staff. That doesn't seem too hypothetical. It seems pretty direct.
Well, I think what you need to show here is that there was in fact some tying in to some specific causation as to the roots. Could you tell me the page of that?
Sure. I'm looking at their reply brief, and it's RA 6. Ms. Myers. And then the next affidavit, Ms. Berner at RA 9, with current loss of income due to the furlough, and the furlough was caused because of the Department of Transportation's decision to allow Virgin America to operate.
It has been part of the reason that United has had to reduce its staff of flight attendants. I think if you look
part
down
at
exactly
why
part of
enough?
The reason. Well, the problem is there is that there's a redressability issue because in that case, even if Virgin America's certificate were pulled,
but none of our standing cases require that it be the sole reason, right? I mean,
well, actually, the decision that the court issued just the other day, the County of Delaware versus DOT, involving the PTC list, it talked about a number of different issues at play, and even if the court upheld the allegations that the petitioner claimed in terms of that particular standard, there were still other bases in which The department or the FAA could have determined, made the determination that they did. So even if that was that factor was removed, the same result would have ensued. And I think the same is true here, where even if you have Virgin America that is taken out of the marketplace, there are other economic factors that could be tied to the reason why these flight attendants are being furloughed.
Not only that, we said in Sierra Club that you've got to meet the standards of a summary judgment motion. I mean, you can't just by affidavit say, this is what I think or this is my understanding. You've got to have specific facts. And when we have affidavits, for instance, in environmental cases where someone says, I have been injured because I can no longer watch these birds or something like that, you really can't go behind that. But here, where an affidavit says simply, it is my belief that the DOT allowance has been part of the reason. With, I mean, that's
yes.
that's not self-evident, I don't think. But
yes.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, and I see that my clock is ticking. So just very briefly, I would like to turn to the merits, and in particular, I'd like to look at the OIG report criteria, which is consistent with the department's actual control standard criteria. There are seven items that the OIG looked to that said that these are indicia of foreign control that need to be addressed. The first one was control via supermajority or disproportionate voting rights. And there, the issue is that the minority owners may not have disproportionate influence with their voting rights. The voting shares of the Virgin Group, the minority foreign shareholder, were below 25%. The minority board representation was reduced from 3 to 2. The non-Virgin Group board members, the Virgin Group board members, were removed from a key committee. There was also the voting trust agreement that was implemented.
Removing, his name was Mr. Reed, right? Removing
yes.
Mr. Reed. How was he situated any differently than a number of the board members who were not removed?
Well, the difference with Mr. Reed.
The point is, if you're going to take him out, why didn't he take others out? Why didn't they take others out?
Well, Mr. Reed had been personally appointed by Mr. Branson, and that was the allegation that he had longstanding ties with the Virgin Group. And I believe, although Mr. Quinn can confirm this, I believe he even had was employed by the Virgin Group previously, whereas not all of these other people that were involved had these longstanding ties to the Virgin
Group. But they had been appointed by Sir Richard, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But they just weren't as good of friends. They hadn't been in the balloon or whatever.
Yes.
Okay.
Also, as to negative control power veto, a number of things were changed. Control rights were taken out. And one thing, before I leave, I want to make sure to make a point that the department has continuing authority and an obligation to review this. So if, in fact, there are instances that demonstrate that Virgin America has transferred shares, or if there is an allegation properly made to the department by way of a petition that this is now controlled by foreign interests, the department can always go back in and do another review of this and make determinations, make findings, and force.
They're making much of the inability to look at the business plan. Is there a new business plan? Is it a different business plan, or is it the same one throughout?
Well, actually, if you look at the stockholders agreement that was revised after Virgin America made all the changes, in fact, a key provision was deleted so that Virgin Group no longer had any control over what essentially what the business plan is. They could not veto any change in what the business would be.
But the business plan itself, was that changed? You're saying the ability to change the governance structure that could affect the business plan was changed. I understand that.
Yes.
Was the business plan itself changed?
I'm not aware of that, and I'd ask Mr. Quinn to answer that, but I don't believe that there was a change. It was more the case whether the Virgin Group can control it.
Do you think there's Article 3 standing here? I know you argued no prudential standing, but you seem to be
giving. No, because we think, first of all, there's no injury in fact.
Okay.
We also believe that there is no nexus. There's no. It's
okay.
Not fairly traceable.
I just didn't know if your argument meant that you thought there was Article III standing. But
no, we don't concede that, Your Honor. We just felt that the prudential standing issue was the stronger of the two. Another point I'd like
to... Isn't a purpose of the Act to protect U.S. carriers?
Yes, it is.
And aren't these employees of U.S. carriers?
Yes, they are.
So why is that not within the zone of interest of the Act?
Well, actually, this is quite different from the Autolog case, which involved a Siemens union. And in that case, a foreign vessel was trying to get into the coastwise trade that, in essence, was taking jobs from U.S. shippers. The difference is under the Merchant Marine Act, there was a Congress specifically provided that the seamen on those vessels in coastal...
Congress doesn't need to intend this specifically, right? But I mean, the language, I have troubles with our prudential standing precedent, but it's precedent, and so you have to follow it. But as I understand it, we have said consistently, and the Supreme Court has said, that the analysis we're supposed to conduct in prudential standings, we're supposed to look at the act that they're bringing suit under, right, and see if it's if the interest they're talking about is arguably protected by the Act. And the Act here talks about protecting U.S. carriers, right? I mean, specifically.
It talks about U.S. carriers, but in fact, in the reply brief, the provisions pointed out by the AFA Council, in fact, are general policy provisions. So it's our contention that, in fact, it's intended to cover air carriers. And in fact, if you look at...
they're part of air carriers.
Well, according to their argument, essentially the zone of interest could extend far beyond specific employees. As I indicated in the Autolog case, the reason that the seamen had the
Siemens. You're right. That statute is much more clear. Much more clear.
Right. Well, and I think safe extensions might be a good example here as well. In that particular case, the FAA. This court said the FAA circular effectively regulates safe extensions because it prevented the company from selling its product to airports. There's no indication at all that AFA is prevented from seeking to unionize Virgin American flight attendants as a result of the DOT's order. So DOT's decision to grant Virgin America a certificate does not destroy the market for AFA's product, which is union membership. In fact, it enlarges it. So I think that is the best example as to why AFA is not within the zone of interest, as this court has interpreted it.
Thank you.
Out of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Quinn.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ken Quinn on behalf of Intervenor Virgin America. May it please the Court. Virgin America has been flying now for 16 months since the DOT certificated them as a U.S. citizen and fit to fly. They're now flying 25 aircraft, employing 1,350 people. The order here, as Your Honors note, occurred after 16 months of painstaking and, frankly, painful review. There's no question here that the statutory numerical criteria have been satisfied and that the President, two-thirds of the board of directors and managing officers, U.S. citizens, no more than 25% voting equity held by non-U.S. citizens. The real question here is, as you've identified, Your Honors, does petitioner have standing, and was DOT's exhaustive review following two different show cause orders based on substantial evidence? We certainly join the government in asserting that neither Article III constitutional injury in fact, that is traceability and redressability, has been established, nor have they are they within the zone of interest.
What's wrong with the latest affidavits?
The latest affidavits are far too speculative and attenuated, I believe, Your Honor, to establish that.
Give me an example. What do you?
It's all personal opinion. They believe that they have been laid off because of flights. We actually pointed out, as Your Honor noted, Judge Griffith, that the reaction to Virgin America's entry on the only affidavit they put in their original brief, the Kelly affidavit, was that they increased flights on that route in the Seattle market. We weren't competing, and they haven't alleged injury on anything other than that route, and a newspaper article that we actually said advised that. So I believe the standing decisions of this court and the Supreme Court indicate that it's far too speculative.
I agree with you about the Wells affidavit. I'm troubled by the later affidavits. It seems to me they might have.
Well, I don't believe the other affidavits are anything more than a personal opinion that's highly speculative and attenuated, that they believe they've been laid off or they're getting having to get food assistance because United Airlines somehow cut back in flights. In fact, the reaction of these carriers, all of whom participated in this case and vociferously objected to Virgin America's certification, and then dropped their objections once the second show cause order came out and we had made so many changes.
What does an affiant have to show at this stage in the affidavit? I mean, you think it's insufficient, for example, when Ms. Hampton says, my understanding is that United is reducing its service because Virgin America is undercutting United and my flying will go to Virgin America. That's insufficient, you think?
I do believe it's insufficient, Your Honor. I think they would have to show actual evidence that the Alaska Airlines here somehow laid off a flight attendant and said they were laying off a flight attendant as a result of the entry of Virgin America.
Let's take Ms. Hampton. How is she going to show that? She's supposed to show board minutes from Alaska Airlines saying that we're cutting back because Virgin America.
You could simply show, Your Honor, the official airline guide that would show that they reduced the schedule in any market involving Virgin America. You could simply show, Your Honor, that market share evidence that we had actually.
That isn't self-evident that they.
I don't believe any of it's self-evident. I think it's a sheer speculation that's highly attenuated.
Do you reject the idea that the notion that in fact these airlines have cut back?
The airlines have cut back, and that just proves the point, I think, that there are many other reasons associated with the schedule reduction, which then, of course, goes to redressability that Your Honor's identified. A favorable ruling by this court does not mean that they would somehow get jobs at the existing carriers, and in fact, as Judge Brown noted, they could also attempt to engage in collective bargaining at Virgin America itself, which would create jobs. But what normally happens when a new entrant comes in is people slash fares, capacity goes up, consumers benefit, there's more traffic, not less traffic, and that's what's happened here. But let me turn to the substantial evidence portion, if I could, because I think there's over 10,000 pages here in the administrative record and 20 substantive pleadings. I'd like to direct Your Honor's attention to just three particular areas which the DOT said, after we made our changes, were tailored to the precise provisions that both the department and opposing carriers suggested were necessary to establish citizenship, and in many cases went even further. And again, we had everyone in this case, including the Airline Pilots Association and the AFL-CIO. Well, I think one of the problems with respect to confidentiality of my distinguished colleague is that AFA didn't enter this case until after 15 months had expired and after the comment period had closed on the second show cause order. Many of these documents have been readily available in the confidential record, but as the Secretary said in announcing the decision, it's tough to think of a company that has done as much to meet our standards for becoming a commercial airline. So in terms of the record evidence, three different things I would point Your Honor's attention to respectfully. One would be in our own filings in the January 17, 2000 objections to the first show cause order. We detailed the changes we had made. That's at Joint Appendix 623 to 631. And then again at 409 and 418 from both January 17 and January 30 submissions of evidentiary material. Second, description of the stripping of the Virgin Group consent rights, the creation of the voting trust, the amendment to the license agreement, all of that can be found in the affidavit of Frances Farrow. She was CEO at the time of Virgin USA, a senior executive with Virgin Group. That's at Joint Appendix 584 to 587. Third, you can find a more complete discussion of the control, the put, the licensing agreement in the affidavit of Professor Alan Shapiro. Principally at Joint Appendix 534 to 538. What he observed, Your Honors, was that our remaining core corporate governance and funding agreements were, quote, standard minority investor protections, which were, quote, not unduly participatory in the strategic direction or daily operations of this company. That was not rebutted in the record. They didn't even attempt it. We've included redlined agreements, and that's part of the Joint Appendix. There are three primary agreements here. You have a subscription agreement, and that's at 6.3C of the subscription agreement. You'll see we've deleted Virgin Group from their veto powers. Section 20A1 and E1C of the stockholders agreement, that's at JA 757 and 760. And then Section 6B of Article 3 of the bylaws, that's at JA 878, 883. Prior to operating, DOT required us to show evidence we have actually adopted these, executed those. But that's where you see that the parties agreed to remove Virgin Group's veto powers over things like changes to the business, filing bankruptcy, declaring dividends, operating other than a substantial conformity with the business plan, everything that the parties at the time had said were tentacles of power that Sir Richard of Virgin Group had. Even we did have a provision that said it would prevent them without their consent of entering into or terminating any material contracts. Again, stripped. Entering into a capital expenditure like an aircraft lease agreement without their approval. Stripped. All of the covenants in the debt agreements, Section 7 of the interim note, Section 10 of the subordinated note, that's at JA 78081 and 80304, stripped in their entirety. Loans without covenants. The license agreement was made a big deal from DOT. We have a new Section 3.7 that directly speaks to the license agreement, making very clear that Virgin America could operate outside of the brand freely, code share freely, without any penalty. And there again, Professor Shapiro said in his affidavit at JA 541 to 543 that the license agreement, as amended, represents extraordinarily flexible and broad rights to operate the license activities in a wide and international scope. And he said, in contrast to other license agreements, they contain far more restrictive geographic provisions and far more detailed provisions, even regulating down to the size of the burger on the bun. They have obviously also relinquished their directors from 3 to 2 out of 9. We included a provision barring their directors from serving on the compensation committee. We provided, Judge Griffin, as you mentioned, affidavits by each one of the board members evidencing independent ratification of various agreements, evidence of independence, a host of contracts amended, ratified, and with the officers. So we've also added, of course, in addition to Chairman Don Carty, the former CEO of American Airlines, Secretary Skinner, my former boss, came in as the vice chairman of the company. He is no shrinking violet. So in sum, Your Honors, DOT put us through the ringer here. There's absolutely no question. We believe, respectfully, we responded quite thoroughly to the application, and as has been done in numerous citizenship cases, including the ASTAR decision Your Honor mentioned, Wings 1 and Wings 2, where Northwest Airlines and KLM came in.
All right, you're way over.
We believe it.
So wind it up.
So we would respectfully believe, Your Honor, that substantial evidence here is ample, and we ask that you affirm the order.
Right,
thank you, Your Honor.
All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
I hope I can talk as fast as my colleague, Mr. Quinn. First of all, injury here is not to the union and would not be redressed by their ability to organize at another carrier. AFA appears here in a representational capacity, and we need only prove then that there's injury to one of our members on account of the DOT order. Now, the Kelly Wells exhibit A214, she did state U.S. DOT's approval of Virgin America to operate as a domestic U.S. carrier has directly increased competition with Alaska Airlines, and among other factors led it to begin a program to reduce flights and staff. Kelly Kohanek on RA13 cites quite specific injury to her personally. I am unable to get my normal flight schedule with Alaska Airlines due to overstaffing, in part because of Virgin America's entry into the markets where I work as an Alaska Airlines flight attendant. I can't get enough flying to cover my bills each month. This was not a problem before Alaska had to make flight cutbacks, in part because the DOT has allowed Virgin America to fly domestic routes within the United States. Now, the fact that the corporation in this issue, Alaska Airlines, is an intermediary does not impede the ability to find the injury is traceable directly to the Department of Transportation order authorizing unlawful foreign carrier competition in domestic markets. There's absolutely no evidence that the business plan has changed, and that is the point. There are a lot of theoretical freedoms that have been created or offered by Virgin America to secure the DOT approval, but these are not really addressing the fundamental business relationships, financial inducements, and the real-world context in which the carrier operates. DOT addressed all that in the first show cause order and came to the correct conclusion. That is, that this is a entity, Virgin America, created by a foreign national. It operates to this day in a manner that advances the interests of the foreign carrier. and they recruited U.S. nominal owners, and they still are the majority of the board and the voting interest in this corporation, that have financial inducements to follow Virgin Group direction. Now, as I hope you review the list of changes that were discussed by Mr. Quinn and Ms. Witham, I ask that you ask yourself, as sophisticated persons who understand business people, ask whether there's any fundamental change that alters the business relationship. And that's the key. The department's precedent always looked in a real-world sense. It was a practical evaluation of what were the financial incentives that would enable a business or a foreign national to exert substantial influence over the U.S. carrier. The real-world context in which these so-called independent actions could be taken, it's all theoretical that you could take the independent action. The real question is, why would you? You're locked into the contracts. There's a real-world cost to exit the contracts. You have plenty of financial inducements, the hedge fund manager, to go along with the Virgin Group direction. There is financial dependence, both in the past. Virgin America's sole source of funding here initially was the Virgin Group, and if you need funds in the future, where are you going to go? The negative control provisions, which were the focus, the entire focus of the DOT's final order and second show cause, are really the least significant of the kinds of mechanisms you might employ to control, to exercise control. DOT has, in fact, recognized that in many cases. DOT will allow negative control provisions, consents, vetoes, to a true minority shareholder, where it perceives that there is no other way to protect their interests. The fact that Virgin America was so eager to give these up suggests that the other relationships that it continues to maintain are much more effective means of exercising that foreign control.
All right, thank you.